Okay, so let's dive into this. What if you're at a friend's place
Right.
and things get a little messy, the police show up, and suddenly your stuff is part of the evidence? Can they do that?
Well, it turns out the answer is more complicated than just owning what's in your pockets. Like,
Right.
it's not that simple.
No.
And this question actually went all the way up to the Supreme Court
Wow.
in a case called Rawlings v. Kentucky.
Okay.
And that case actually decided this very issue of standing in searches and seizures.
So we're diving deep into a case that hinges on a purse, a pile of drugs, and a lot of cash.
Yeah, this is a good one.
This is going to be good.
So it all started back in 1976 in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Picture this: police officers roll up to a house with an arrest warrant for a guy named Lawrence Marquess. But when they get there,
Oh.
they find Marquess isn't alone.
So there are other people in the house when the police arrive.
Exactly.
That already sounds like a recipe for trouble.
It does, doesn't it? There are four other people there, including a woman named Vanessa Cox and the star of our legal drama, David Rawlings.
Got it.
Now, while the police are looking for Marquess, they smell marijuana and
Oh.
they see some marijuana seeds out in the open.
Okay, red flag number one.
Exactly. So two officers head out to get a search warrant while the others detain everyone at the house.
Okay.
Now, this detention becomes a really crucial point later on.
Okay.
So keep it in mind. About 45 minutes later, the officers return with the warrant, read everyone their Miranda rights. And
Okay.
that's when things get really interesting.
Okay, I'm all ears.
Rawlings and Cox are on a couch with Cox's purse sitting between them. The officers tell Cox to empty her purse.
Okay.
And what did they find? A ton of illegal drugs,
Uh-oh.
including 1,800 LSD tablets.
Wow. That escalated quickly. So
Okay.
what happens next? Do they arrest Chalks?
Well, that's where it takes another turn.
Okay.
Cox tells Rawlings to take what's his.
What?
And Rawlings, right there in front of the police, claims all the drugs are his.
He just admitted to it,
Yep.
like it was no big deal.
Oh. And of course, he's immediately arrested. To
Right.
make matters worse, they search him
Uh-oh.
and find $4,500 in cash and a knife on him.
So he goes from a casual visit to a potential drug trafficking charge,
Right.
all because of what was found in someone else's purse.
Yep.
That doesn't seem right.
And that's exactly what Rawlings argued. He said he shouldn't be convicted
Yeah.
because even though he owned the drugs, he didn't have control over the purse where they were found.
Right.
He's basically saying, hey, it was her purse, not mine.
Yeah, I'm starting to see where this whole standing issue comes into play. So is this all about whether Rawlings had a right to privacy over that purse, even though he didn't actually own it?
You got it.
Okay.
This is the question that went all the way to the Supreme Court.
Wow.
They had to figure out what legitimate expectation of privacy means in this context.
Okay, break that down for me. What does legitimate expectation of privacy actually mean in a case like this?
It is a bit
Yeah,
tricky.
it seems like kind of a gray area.
The Supreme Court said it's not just about whether you own the thing that was searched. It's about whether you had a reasonable expectation of privacy over the place where it was kept.
Okay.
So in Rawlings's case, did he have a reasonable expectation of privacy in Cox's purse?
Wouldn't you think that just owning the drugs would give Rawlings some kind of protection? I mean, they were his belongings.
That's a good question, and it gets to the heart of the debate in this case.
Yeah.
The Supreme Court looked at a few things. Rawlings had only known Cox for a few days.
Okay.
He didn't have any control over her purse, and someone else had already been in the purse earlier that day.
Okay.
Based on all that, they decided he didn't have a legitimate expectation of privacy in the purse.
Wow. So even though he owned the drugs, that wasn't enough to challenge the search of the purse itself.
Exactly. The court essentially said that you can own something, but if you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy where it's kept, you can't claim your Fourth Amendment rights were violated. That raises some interesting questions about where we draw the line when it comes to privacy.
Absolutely. This is already making me rethink how I view the Fourth Amendment. But wait, what about the fact that Rawlings was detained for 45 minutes while the police were getting the warrant?
Right.
It seems like the legality of that detention should have had some impact on the case.
Right. You're absolutely right. That detention becomes a key part of the legal battle.
Yeah.
Rawlings argued that his admission to owning the drugs shouldn't be allowed because it happened during an illegal detention.
That makes sense. So what does the Supreme Court have to say about that? Did they agree that the detention was illegal?
Here's where it gets a bit complicated. The court actually acknowledged that the 45-minute detention was probably illegal, but they also ruled that Rawlings admitting to owning the drugs was a voluntary statement and therefore could be used as evidence.
Wait, hold on. How can a confession be voluntary if it happened during an illegal detention? That seems like a contradiction.
It does, doesn't it? The majority of the justices focus on a few things. They said that Rawlings was read his Miranda rights, the detention wasn't excessively long, and the overall atmosphere was described as congenial.
Okay.
So they basically reasoned that because of these factors, his confession wasn't coerced.
So even though the detention itself might have been unlawful, they separated that from his admission of owning the drugs.
Exactly. They decided the circumstances around his confession made it voluntary despite the potentially illegal detention. But of course, not everyone on the court agreed with this line of reasoning.
Okay.
And we're going to talk about that next because there are some really interesting dissenting opinions in this case.
Great. Can't wait to hear more about those.
All right.
So.
Yeah.
So there were dissenting opinions in this case.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear more about what the other justices had to say about all of this.
There absolutely were. Justice Marshall, for example, wrote a powerful dissent where he argued that the Fourth Amendment was designed to protect property rights, too. He believed that just because Rawlings' drugs were in someone else's purse, that shouldn't have taken away his right to challenge the search.
Interesting.
Like, if they were his drugs, he had standing.
Okay, so Justice Marshall dissented, focusing on property rights.
Yeah.
Were there any other notable opinions from the justices?
Yes, Justice Blackmun actually agreed with the majority that Rawlings didn't have standing in this specific case.
Okay.
But he also brought up a really interesting point. He suggested that property rights can actually play a role in determining Fourth Amendment protections in other circumstances.
So he's saying ownership isn't completely irrelevant, it just depends on the situation.
Precisely. He emphasized the right to exclude as a key element of property rights.
Okay.
He basically said that if someone has the right to prevent others from accessing a certain space, that could actually strengthen their claim to a reasonable expectation of privacy in that space.
That makes a lot of sense. So owning something might not automatically grant you privacy rights, but it could definitely be a factor in certain situations.
Mm-hmm.
What about the other justices? Did any of them have a different take on how the lower court handled the case?
Actually, yes. Justice White took a more procedural approach to the case.
What?
He argued that the Kentucky Supreme Court didn't properly address whether Rawlings' confession was truly voluntary given the circumstances of his detention.
Interesting. So he's not necessarily disagreeing with the outcome of the case. He's more concerned about the process the lower court used to get there.
That's right. He believed the case should have been sent back to the lower court to reevaluate whether the detention had actually influenced the voluntariness of Rawlings' confession. He wanted them to take a closer look at it with the proper legal framework in mind.
Wow. This case is a lot more complex than I originally thought. We've got the majority ruling focused on privacy, Justice Marshall arguing for a stronger emphasis on property rights, and Justice White raising questions about the lower court's process. It really shows how much nuance there is in Fourth Amendment law.
Absolutely. Rawlings v. Kentucky wasn't just about one guy and a purse full of drugs. It had broader implications for how we interpret the Fourth Amendment, especially when it comes to standing privacy and how confessions are treated when they're obtained during a potentially illegal detention.
Okay, so let's shift gears a bit and talk about those broader implications.
Mm-hmm.
What are the key takeaways from this case? What does it mean for lawyers and law students?
This case is a powerful reminder that the Fourth Amendment often comes down to privacy, not just ownership.
Okay.
If you're working with a client facing a similar situation, you need to analyze whether they had a legitimate expectation of privacy in the place that was searched.
Okay.
It's not enough to just point to the fact that they owned the items that were seized.
So you're saying it's crucial to advise clients to be careful about where they keep their belongings.
Right.
Don't assume that just because you own something, it's automatically protected from being searched.
Exactly. And you also need to carefully scrutinize any confessions made during a detention. If there's any question about whether the detention was legal, you have to challenge the voluntariness of that confession.
Okay.
Was the client read their Miranda rights? How long did the detention last? Was there any coercive behavior from law enforcement?
All right.
All of these factors are critical to consider.
This has been so informative. It's incredible how much we can learn from a single Supreme Court case.
I agree. And the discussion isn't over yet. I want to leave you with one more thought to ponder something to consider in light of everything we've talked about today.
Okay, I am ready for that thought-provoking question.
Hit me with it.
I'm ready for that thought-provoking question. Hit me with it.
Well, we've seen how this case really favored the privacy side of the equation when interpreting the Fourth Amendment, but it also brings up a really interesting debate.
Okay.
Should the law put more emphasis on property rights in situations like this? Think about it. If you own something, shouldn't that give you some level of legal protection over it, even if it's not directly in your possession?
That's a great point.
Yeah.
Honestly, I hadn't really considered that perspective before. It makes me think about all the times I've left something at a friend's place or even borrowed someone's bag, you know?
Right.
This case suddenly feels very relatable.
Rawlings v. Kentucky might have been decided decades ago, but the questions it raises are still relevant today. As technology changes and our lives become increasingly intertwined, figuring out where the lines are between privacy, property, and our Fourth Amendment rights is going to get even more complex.
So what does this all mean for us? It seems like Rawlings v. Kentucky really challenges those simple assumptions we might have about privacy. It tells us that our Fourth Amendment rights are more connected to the places we have control over rather than simply the things we own.
That's a great summary.
Yeah.
And it highlights why it's so important to understand the nuances of the law. Cases like this show why seeking legal counsel is crucial when those lines start to blur.
Absolutely. It's a good reminder that even seemingly simple actions like leaving our belongings at a friend's house can have surprisingly complex legal implications. We need to be more aware of that.
I agree. This case really drives home the point that we need to be mindful of our actions and understand the legal landscape, even in everyday situations. The law is all around us, even in a borrowed purse.
Well, this deep dive into Rawlings v. Kentucky has been a real eye-opener for me. It's amazing how much we can learn from just one Supreme Court case.
I'm glad to hear that. And I hope our discussion today has given you a deeper understanding of Fourth Amendment principles and how complicated the concept of standing can be in search and seizure cases.
It definitely has. Thanks to everyone for joining us on this deep dive. We'll see you next time.